Pursuing Sexual Purity in Modern Culture, the fifth talk in a series titled Love, Sex, and Marriage, was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 26, 2005, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Pursuing sexual purity in the modern world. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what sexual purity is, what that would mean, and then what challenges we face in the modern world in that regard. Most people in American culture would consider my views on sexual purity to be pretty old-fashioned, probably is the word they would use. But also I think they would be greatly misunderstood. So let me try to put in context what I'm saying here. I don't believe my views are old-fashioned in the sense that I'm conservative or that I am old-fashioned by temperament. I don't think I am. I just think that I'm trying to come to terms with what the Bible is actually teaching us about human sexuality and what we should do and how we should invest our sexuality. And that happens to be what the Bible teaches seems to be more compatible with values that used to be hold sway in our culture and are being lost rapidly in the modern culture and in the modern times for a variety of reasons. But when we talk about sexual purity, there's most people think that there's really only two options. You're either kind of Victorian, prudish, maybe even ascetic on the one hand, and I'll define what those are in a second, or you're of the opinion that sex is natural, and because it's natural, it's really okay. So just don't be hung up, just relax and enjoy your sexuality. And those seem to be the two options that people think that they get to choose between or have to choose between. I would argue that the biblical perspective is neither of those. It's not compatible with Victorianism. It's not ascetic. It doesn't deny the legitimacy of pleasure and passion and that sort of thing. It has its place, and the Bible recognizes that, on the one hand. On the other hand, the Bible's perspective is not that it is just natural in the sense that you can do whatever you want with your sexuality because sexuality is okay. There's a passage, I don't remember if I looked at it in this series or not, but in the 1 Corinthians 6 passage where he says, food is for the stomach and the stomach is for food, that maybe I looked at that passage. But the argument that Paul seems to be responding to in that passage is the position that sex is just like eating. It's something that we need to do. It's a biological need, a biological desire. God gave it to us. There's nothing wrong with it. So if you have a desire that you need to fulfill, then fulfill the desire. That's all there is to it. And Paul's response is, no, that's not all there is to it. We as human beings were made for holiness. We were made to serve God. We were made to obey God and to glorify God in our bodies. And part of the assumption behind that is we need to recognize that there's a difference between animal sexuality and human sexuality. Animal sexuality is not moral. Moral categories and moral considerations are not relevant to an animal because they are not moral beings. But while there may be some, you know, striking similarities in our biological urges and animal urges, we were not made to be slaves of our urges in the way that animals are. We are made to be moral beings and to have moral considerations enter in and dictate how we are going to deal with whatever urges we feel. So questions like, but is it right? Is it good? is it true, is it honest, become relevant to us as human beings and are therefore relevant to human sexuality in the way that they aren't to bestial sexuality. So that's not the biblical perspective, that it's natural and therefore you just need to not be hung up and just do whatever you want and enjoy your sexuality. The biblical perspective is between those two, in a sense, if you will. The people who, surprisingly, the people who probably have written the best and have the best attitude on it are the Puritans. Oftentimes the adjective puritanical is used to describe the Victorian attitude, but that's a misnomer because the Puritans were not Victorians. The Puritans were not hung up, if you will, about their sexuality. The Puritans believed that sexuality had a place, and it was in the context of marriage and the lifelong commitment that a husband and wife have to each other. But within that context, to enjoy the passion and the delight and the pleasure of sexuality between husband and wife is perfectly fine. It's a gift from God to be received gratefully. But there's a right and proper context and role for sexuality, and the Puritans believe very firmly that sexuality needs to stay within the bounds of what God created it to do. Well, I think they have that right. I think their perspective was basically the biblical perspective. But let me define some terms here. What do I mean by Victorianism? The Victorians were really strange people. It was a strange time in English culture. It was a strange time in the world. I didn't understand this until I read a book on the history of sexuality where they described where the Victorians got their ideas. But basically, their view of sexuality was driven by their theology, because they had a theology that said original sin or sin is passed on through procreation. And as it happens, the more passionate the act of sexual intercourse, the more passionate it is, the more deeply and profoundly sinful the offspring will be. So the reason that you tried to repress passion and sensuality and mostly passion, the reason Victorians were intent on repressing passion was because they wanted to minimize the effect of original sin in the world. Well, I'm not sure where they came up with those ideas, but anyway, I mean, at least it was a noble motive. But in the course of wanting to repress passion, they invented Graham crackers, which supposedly were invented to reduce your sexual desire and your sexual drive, cornflakes or Wheaties or something, some breakfast cereal. All of those were calculated to help us not quite so sexual. And then in culturally, their attitudes were to try to basically deny sexuality altogether, to pretend like it didn't exist. And so anything that could possibly be construed as reminding you of the fact that we are sexual beings was taboo. I mean, you don't think about it, you don't mention it, you don't talk about it, it's impolite. Even to the point where, if you notice in Victorian house decor, you have long tablecloths that cover up the legs of the table because you don't want to be thinking about legs. So that culture did indeed have a huge impact on American culture, on our culture. As I was growing up as a child, there was a lot, it was socially a lot more repressive than it is now. And what I mean by that is, I did confront attitudes, I picked up on attitudes that there's something kind of spooky about sex. You want to stay away from it, you want to avoid the subject, you don't want to think about it, you don't want to be honest about it, you just leave that alone. And if you leave it alone, maybe it'll go away, sort of the attitude. And even in my childhood, as late as in my childhood, there was still some of that influence, I think, in our culture. Then we had the sexual revolution in the 1960s, with my generation leading the way, and everything changed. My point is, Was there something to rebel against? Yeah, I think so. I mean, that the Victorian influence culture did not have a healthy view, a healthy biblical view of sexuality. I think that's true, on the one hand. On the other hand, where did we go? We went toward trying to turn sexuality into as much, as close to a bestial act as we possibly could. And that, of course, is not going in the biblical direction. That's going somewhere else entirely. And that's kind of what we confront today. So what, just briefly and quickly, what would I think that sexual purity actually is then? How would I define it? I have several statements here, but sexual purity, I think, are attitudes and actions which appreciate one's sexuality for what in fact it was intended to be, and that do not distort and pervert one's sexuality into something other than what God intended it to be. So namely, that it appreciates and acknowledges that sexuality is a means to expressing and celebrating marital commitment to one spouse, to whom I am in fact committed, a celebration and expression which rightly and appropriately involves passion, sensual pleasure, and emotional pleasure as components of the celebration itself. So anything that honors, respects, and acknowledges sexuality is that, I would argue, is sexual purity. Okay, now notice in that I'm rejecting asceticism as well. Asceticism is the view that anything that has anything to do with bodily pleasure is somehow unspiritual and is somehow contrary to spirituality, and that if we want to pursue spirituality, then we need to forsake anything of body or material pleasure altogether, physical pleasure altogether. That's not a biblical perspective as well, I think. That's a Greek perspective, an ancient Greek perspective that had a huge impact on early Christianity, admittedly, and there are streams of that attitude that are still within Christian versions of Christian culture today. But that's not the biblical perspective. In fact, explicitly denied by Paul in 1 Corinthians. He explicitly takes that on and says, no, you got that wrong. Well, we can talk about defining, I'll leave that to your questions, to define sexual purity. What I want to do is talk about what are the components of an internal moral fortitude that we need to develop, I think, if we're going to live in this modern world with the pressures that we face and be able to be sexually pure, that is, have a pure attitude towards sexuality. The first one is we need to train ourselves, I think, to reject sensuality. Now, not reject the sensual, but to reject sensuality, if you understand the distinction I'm making. Part of our human experience is going to be sensual. That's true. And there are sensual pleasures and there are sensual delights of one kind or another, including in the context of sexuality and outside the context of sexuality. And that's all fine. But part of what it means to be a believer, part of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus, is to recognize that there are more important things than the sensual. If the sensual is there as a serendipitous gift from God, great. Receive it and accept it with gratitude to the God who made it and who gave it to you. But to make your life about the sensual is a fundamental mistake. It's a spiritual and moral mistake that we make. It's a mistake we fall into very easily, very readily. So we pursue drugs that make us feel the way we want to feel, or we pursue love and romance to make us feel the way we want to feel, or sexual addiction because it makes us feel the way we want to feel, or any number of other ways in which food can be an incredible trap for people, the sensual delight of food. Becoming obsessed with having the best, the sensual best in my life. It's not that it's wrong in and of itself, but what becomes wrong is when that becomes the defining focus of our lives, because it crowds out what is actually ought to be the defining focus of our life, righteousness and goodness and wisdom and the character that flows out of those things. That's what counts. That's what's eternal. the smells and the tastes and the feelings of this world are going to pass away. They're not even going to be relevant for the vast majority of my existence. But what is always going to be irrelevant is me being a person with a heart committed to that which is right and just and good. And that has to take precedence over the sensual. Well, if it doesn't, if we're already committed to sensuality, then there is nothing more sensual than sexuality and all the images of sexuality and the allurements and the bait that is floated before me every day is going to just make me bite. It's going to take me in, because there's no more powerful urge, no more powerful seductive lure than sexuality. So if we're going to be pure, we need to work on rejecting sensuality in all of its forms in our life, I think. Second thing is we need to insist on rejecting the myth, the lie, of what I will call sexual salvation. It's current in our mythology, in our culture. We see it in almost every movie, at least every love story that we go to in the movies these days, is you're unhappy, you're miserable, you're in confusion, your life is in chaos, until that right person comes along, until that lover comes along. And then when you find that lover, then the story ends with the implicit assumption we live happily ever after, even though we're not so corny as to say that any longer. That's still the mythology that is very powerful in our culture. In the early stages, I was talking last week about eros and romantic love, this organic, God-given, God-created drug that we can come under the effects of. When we're under the effects of that love, that story seems plausible. It seems true. It feels like this love is going to last forever, and it's never going to die. And I will be happy forever and ever and ever, and there will be no more problems in my life that I can't overcome and that I can't solve, because with my lover, I am strong enough to handle anything and to meet any challenge and so on. It feels that way, and I know that it feels that way, but it's not reality. There's no substance to that feeling. It's only a symbol of what could be. It's not the reality of what is. So rejecting that lie is crucial, I think, because otherwise, once again, we leave ourselves vulnerable to someone coming along and suggesting, oh, well, never mind all that morality stuff. Herein lies your salvation. Here is your true love. Here is your lover. And they're going to solve everything for you. Third thing I think we need to do is, and this of course is true for all of our life, but make a commitment to integrity and conscientiousness in the context of my relationship with others. And especially as a sexual being, integrity and conscientiousness in what I do with my body, what I say with my body, what I promise another person with my body. If I don't mind being dishonest and defrauding people and lying to people, then I'm going to be a lot more ready to use my sexuality casually. But if I recognize and I'm convinced that sexuality means something, and it involves another person, and the question is, am I going to defraud them? Am I going to lie to them? Well, I automatically have put boundaries on what I will and will not do with my body sexually if I have decided I'm not going to defraud people, I'm not going to lie to them, and understand that sexuality is a way of lying. Fourthly, this is crucial as just disciples of Jesus across the board, a commitment to doing what is right, a commitment to principle. I am not going to have sex with you because that would be wrong. I mean, that we need to become the kind of people where because that would be wrong settles the question. Now, that gets difficult because the desires run so deep and so strong. And we want to satisfy our desires. That's what we want. But the question is, are we so committed in principle to doing what's good and what's right that it doesn't really matter how deep and strong the desires run? I'm not going to violate what's right just to satisfy my desire. If I'm not moving toward that kind of commitment, then we're just going to get swept headlong by our passions into all kinds of foolish action. So we have to decide that it's important to me to do what's right. And then finally, and in particular, this has a particular application to sexuality, we need to reject the evil use of our imagination and make a commitment to rejecting escape and flight from reality and stay in reality and live in reality. The reason I say that particularly pertains to sexuality is because the more I've lived, the more I've experienced, the more I've watched, the more I've observed, it seems to me that the attraction and the power of sexual desire is fundamentally a head trip. It's fundamentally a function of imagination, even to the point of fantasy. The fact of the matter is, I don't think actual sexual experience and sexual intimacy, for the most part, can ever possibly measure up to what we wish it would be and hope it would be and fantasize that it will be. That gets fed, of course, because we're given all kinds of images with music in the background and filters on the lenses and so on to get this picture of lovers in love, lovers making love to one another, in a context that real life will never deliver. Real life will never be that way. And there's a tremendous temptation when you're faced with that kind of image of sexual experience to say, I don't want life. I don't want reality. I want that. That's what I want. And I'm sure there are people who spend their whole life in pursuit of that fantasy, that lie, that myth, that story that gets told that is such an attractive story. I mean, I'm not even sure I can analyze why it's so attractive, but it just gets its hook in us. And it has this powerful allure that what you want that, Jack, that's what you want your experience to be like. And the only antidote to that is to be able to say, well, actually, I don't want that. Actually, I want to live my life with both feet on the ground. Actually, I want my life to be about what God created life to be, not what we would like to recreate life into. I don't want to escape sexuality as God actually designed it to be. I want real sex with a real woman in a real world. That's what I want. But that's not an easy decision to make, especially in this day and age where we get fed these images day in and day out, presenting a whole nother order of existence that has no relationship to the actual world we live in. So nothing short of a commitment to say, a resolve on my part, to want to live in reality is going to be good enough to fortify us against the pressures I think that we're going to face. Okay, and what are those pressures in the modern world? Well, one I've already alluded to, the seductive, alluring images in the mainstream media, which promote and encourage sensuality on the one hand. They promote a mythical conception of the nature and purpose of sexuality on the other hand, the myth of sexual salvation in particular. They promote rebelliousness with respect to our sexuality. Sexual rebellion is cool, if you haven't noticed. And the absence of commitment. I mean, just every TV show these days has people supposedly living out a paradigm of sexuality where you don't need to be committed, you don't need to stay with one person, The next person is a wonderful person who's bringing meaning and purpose to your life out of the chaos of your life. I mean, all that stuff that are part of the lies and mythology in our culture are promoted in every TV show, in every movie, in every commercial that we look at. And part of the problem there, Wes taught me this years and years and years ago in a paper that he wrote, part of the problem there is the power of images. that Wes's paper was about how we no longer live in a, I think you called it a word culture, but in an image culture. We're no longer dealing with ideas in our culture. We're always dealing with pictures, visual images. Visual images are far more powerful, psychologically powerful, than words on the one hand, but even more importantly, they're much harder to combat. Because you don't argue. I mean, if someone came along and made a deductive proof for the bestial nature of human sexuality, you'd just say, that's a fallacy, your proof is wrong. And you would have defeated it. And you could, you know, it wouldn't have impacted you because you'd see through the fallacy of what they're saying, you'd see how ridiculous their conclusion was and the implications of that, and you would just reject it. But give me a movie with images, with filtered lenses and music and short, brief shots where I don't have to see AIDS and venereal disease and guilt and shame and self-hatred and all the stuff that goes with that. And I don't see that on the screen. All I see are these alluring, seductive images of sex, sensuality, sexual salvation, love, wonderful love, and so on. How do you argue with that? Who wouldn't want that? And the only way to combat it, I think, is to reduce those images to propositions. What are they saying? What is their worldview? What is their perspective? What are they claiming is true about human sexuality? And then deciding, do I not believe that? And then if I don't believe it, reject it. But it comes to that resolve once again. I need to be resolved to stay in reality in order to be able to reject it. Because if I just allow the images to be as alluring and as seductive as they are, I can't beat it. Those cinematographers are too good for me to be able to just reject the image on its own terms. It won't happen. I have to be critical. And in order to be critical, I have to reduce it to assertions and statements and recognize the false lie, deception of the assertion. We combat a culture now where people in their everyday mundane circumstances, in their conduct and conversation, encourage sensuality, promiscuity, adultery, and all the other forms of sexual perversion. It just becomes commonplace to hear people talking about their affair, their one-night stand, their this, their that, and are constantly establishing this prevailing attitude that's out there in the culture. In order to fit in, we might find ourselves joining. I mean, it would be easy to find ourselves joining. You know, you're working on a construction site with some construction workers, and you see a good-looking woman, a good-looking female walking down the street, and their tendency is to enjoy the sensuality of gazing at her, or what's the word? Ogling her, whatever. Do I join them in that? Well, I mean, to the extent that I join them in that, I'm allowing the prevailing cultural attitude to become my attitude. It's at that level, it seems to me, where we just need to decide, no, I'm not going to go there. I'm not about that. That's not how I define my life and my existence. Today, we face an unprecedented onslaught of pornography, and pornography is just a huge problem. Pornography is what plays into the head trip aspect of sexuality, the fantasy, the imagination, this whole other world, turning sexuality into something that it really isn't, but pretending that it is, and longing for it, and wanting it, and wishing for it, and seeking to enjoy it, and the adrenaline rush that comes from the excitement that brings. Pornography, I would argue, is basically a drug. It's an adrenaline-inducing drug, and it's the drug high that makes it work. So I think we need to recognize it for what it is. It's a very addictive drug that we just need to stay away from if we don't want to become addicted to it. And it's just so much easier because you don't have, in my day growing up, you had to go looking for it to find it. In this day and age, it comes looking for you. And God help us. I mean, we just need to be that much more diligent in our efforts to just not allow it to have any room in my life. Just say no to it. Because it's going to come knocking on the door. It's going to come looking for us. And we just need to say no to it. We face the problem today since the sexual revolution of the ready availability of sexual partners, because there's so much lack of moral restraint in our society, and certainly a lack of moral restraint in the area of sexuality, that I'm sure if you wanted to, you could find sexual partners quite readily, quite easily. Again, it's our resolve to want to use our sexuality in a way that's in keeping with goodness, and being committed to that, that's going to protect us. Because we are a culture that tends to accept a debased view of human sexuality, we are, after all, just animals, that kind of perspective. It's an animal appetite to be indulged however one likes. That fosters the myth that goes along with it that everybody wants sex anytime, anywhere. And it creates a climate, therefore, that has led to things like date rape. I think date rape, I don't know, but I would be really surprised. I mean, I would imagine that the perpetrators of date rape, in a strange, perverse sort of way, think they're doing the woman a favor. Because, I mean, you have to feel sorry for us males in this culture to a certain extent. Because on the one hand, we get sent that message over and over and over again, that sexuality is this natural animal appetite that everybody wants to participate in. The only reason they don't participate in it is because of certain cultural inhibitions that Christianity has taught them or something like that. And so I'm just going to be this brave, courageous soul who participates in what we all want anyway, right? I mean, that's what all the messages keep telling us. And so it comes as a sort of surprise, I would imagine, when it's not treated as if you have done somebody a favor. So we have this mixed message. Show restraint and respect on the one hand, and yet we have a view of sexuality where respect has nothing to do with it. Where's respect supposed to come from? Only Christianity can really understand, has a theory of sexuality, can really understand that. Okay, why don't I stop and leave it to you to take us where you want to go with your questions.
When you say reject sensuality, you're talking about things that affect our senses. Is that right?
Well,
our senses in general, like
things that affect my senses are sensual, but sensuality is where I go one step further and I make the things which affect my senses that which I put center most in my life, foremost in my life somehow.
So you're not limiting sensuality to just like sexual sensuality, but you could say being obsessed with vegetables or chocolate or rollerblading, like anything that excites your senses.
Yeah.
Okay. I think I have another question, but I can't.
But the reason I mention in this context is you don't get more powerful or alluring sensual experience than in sexuality.
To say no to sensuality, to making that a defining characteristic of your view of life, how would that be practiced? How would that be walked out? I'm just trying to imagine, like, I know you're not advocating an aesthetic way of living, so I'm trying to figure out how that applies to all.
Well, it's mostly up here. It's mostly where my head is headed, how I'm orienting my thoughts. My brother David once, when he was in college, described a dinner that he went to one time with a friend of his and the fiance of a friend of his, and they spent the entire dinner critiquing the flavors of every dish on the table. A very refined. I mean, an obsession with, so what exactly does this taste like, and how delicious is it really, and how exquisite is it, and is it lacking in any regard? Well, that's a paradigm for me of sensuality. I mean, there has to come a point in our life where we are able to say, I mean, like, who cares? I mean, it's food. I'll live. You can do that with odors. You can do that with tastes. You can do that with touch. You can just become so obsessed with the actual enjoyment of the pleasure of the sensual experience itself, whatever that sensual experience might be. And that's fine when it comes. I mean, God gave us the senses. God gave us the capability of having sensual experiences. But his intention was not that we make our whole life about and defined by having those sensual experiences, sensual experiences, and making sure that we have them. I mean, where you really see sensuality is when people pursue them then. I've got to have that sensual experience. So you organize your calendars around it. You organize your schedule around it. And pretty soon, you've got yourself scheduled for a massage and aromatherapy and a fine dinner here and that, and you don't have any time for obedience after a while. You don't have any time for loving people and caring for people and serving people. It's all about you getting what your senses want. I mean, that would be an extreme, but that's what I mean by sensuality.
So it would not be so much like deny that you like the taste of this food, or deny that you enjoy music that makes you happy. It's more like don't define your life by it.
Right. Right.
Don't bank your life on it. Don't define your life.
Right. The root of asceticism actually sees a sensual experience as somehow a sin or a moral failure or at least something that has robbed you of spirituality. So you'd have a scent, you know, you'd catch a waft of a fragrance of a flower and feel guilty, I suppose, because, oh, no, not that. That's this world, you know. That's not the biblical picture. I mean, if God serendipitously, and I mean, don't be ridiculous. I mean, you can even plan for a nice dinner, something that you expect to be a delight to your senses. I mean, that's fine too. As long as if you got interrupted, it doesn't wreck your life. The sensual person has to have that because it's the meaning of his existence. The believer, the disciple of Jesus, can delight in all of those things, but if they are taken away, that's fine, because it's not life itself. Kierkegaard has a wonderful passage in Fear and Trembling where he's defining the night of faith, and he ends up describing the night of faith as this guy who works as a banker or an accountant or something like that in some office. And as he's working away at his tedious, boring, mundane work, he starts thinking about I think he calls it a ram's head that they're going to have for dinner. Not exactly my idea of a good time, but they're going to have this ram's head for dinner, and he starts smelling the smells, savoring what this experience is going to be like. And he gets off work, and he walks home, and he stops at the pub, and he enjoys a pint of something or other with his friends. And he heads home, he gets home, and his wife tells him, they were out of ram's head, or I didn't have enough money for ram's head, so we're having something else instead. And that's just all right with him. And that's the person that Kierkegaard defines as the knight of faith. Now, I think what he's trying to say there is that because his life is not about sensual experience, he is free to enjoy sensual experience. He can enjoy what is to be the pleasures of this life right alongside any hedonist, but if it's taken away from him for some reason, if he's thwarted in that regard, that's okay with him too, because it doesn't define his existence, while the hedonist has to have it because that's what gives meaning to his life.
So that'd be like being poor in spirit, where you can own a pleasure at one moment or another. It could be given to you and you could enjoy it, but it would not own you.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
So it would be like content with daily bread, and if you get whipped cream someday, you'd
right.
be like, oh, that's great. But
right.
it's not like, oh, this is my existence.
Right. That becomes crucial in the context of sexuality, particularly in the context of married sexuality, because there are so many different seasons of your life, and you can't live your life as a married couple being starstruck lovers in love and passionate love with each other. Things happen in life. You get tired, you get old, you get bored, all kinds of stuff happens that prevents the possibility of it being the same kind of sensual experience that it is at other times. Well, what are you going to do about that? You know, is if your life is meaningless, if you're thrown into despair because sex isn't what you would hope it would be or want it to be or whatever, then there's something desperately wrong with the perspective. I need to be able to let life be what life is and let life give me what life will give me and not demand more and crave more and long for more if it's not there to be had. But sensuality doesn't allow you to be content.
I was wondering what you just said to Jen, how that would apply to someone whose profession or livelihood is based around sensuality, in a sense like a musician or a cook or a dancer. I mean, they're focused on a sense. How does that relate?
I was just thinking that of a similar response, that one of the things you were talking about is the notion of connoisseurship. To be a connoisseur of something is to become sort of an expert in the details and nuances and character and nature of something such that you enjoy it as an expert. And I think all I was going to say is that I think that there are, and it applies to her question, I think, is it's possible to be a connoisseur. But as you've already said, you mustn't let your connoisseur-ishness or vocation or even your opportunity to dance or to be a chef or to whatever it might be, to be a visual artist, detract you from the core issues of your relationship with God. So I'm picturing in my mind right now a couple of people that I know, two or three people that I know, who are either chefs or they are, in fact, one or two of them actually are in the related to vineyards or wineries or something, where they develop very fine-tuned art form liquid.
Liquid art.
And I just think that you have to be able to, if you can't make the distinction, then you're in trouble. Because it's possible to be a connoisseur of something, or to let connoisseurship overtake your life, such that that's what life is about.
Yeah.
That's what you live for. You live from one sort of highly sensitized, if not ecstatic, wonderful experience of one thing to the next, to the next, to the next. That's what you talk about. That's what you think about. That's what your life is based on. That's what your living is all about. I mean, that's deadly.
Have you ever seen Babette's Feast? The movie Babette's Feast? I like it. It's a story of there's this little kind of very, what, how would you describe them? Victorian? Yeah, there's austere, that's the word I'm looking for, kind of austere religious cult in Denmark or something like that. And this woman who's a French chef comes and lives with them, and it's all about this one feast that she gives them on this festival day one time. And I'm not sure what the message of the movie is. I'm not sure I understand that well enough to know whether I would agree with the ultimate message of the movie. But what I like about the movie is that this connoisseur, this woman who has real expertise with food, is giving a gift to this group of people that have taken her in and have loved her and accepted her. And she's giving them this gift. So it's a very important reminder to me that sensual delights is one way that the sensual can be transcended. if through the sensual a human being is touching another human being in love and showing them and demonstrating love and kindness to them through those things, then it's not just sensual. It's something far, far more than that, far greater than that. So I think my answer would be, we always want to seek to use the thing that I have connoisseurship or expertise in to try to operate in such a way that I transcend the sensual in what I give to people.
The only other comment I'll make, it does occur to me, having watched some artists over the years and been around people who are involved in something that is a physical, sensual, intellectual, but basically kind of a world that is oriented around those. It is a peculiar, for some, a peculiar trial or temptation to be so close to it all the time that to be able to mature in a field of the arts or in one of those things that we've been talking about and to actually have perspective on it is really, really important and also, unfortunately, very rare. So that there... But the opposite reaction to that would be, and oftentimes is, a sort of asceticism, which is equally mistaken.
Yeah.
So it's just that if God has given one a calling or a vocation in one of those areas, hopefully God will provide the kind of insight, teaching, fellowship, support, accountability, all those kinds of things that the body of Christ is supposed to support itself with, in such a way that a person in that environment can be supported in that environment with a wise perspective. And I think it's critical for people in the arts in particular.
This relates to sexual purity because it's one of the ways that I used to think of. For a while, I thought that, well, especially like in the areas of child training, like you should protect your children as much as possible from like the images that you've described, and that will help them develop sexual purity. I think for a while I thought you should not limit that because you want them to develop sexual purity from their heart. But then I've also thought like it would be a good thing to limit that because it's hard to think through them. You know, you can't really combat them. So do you want to comment on filters?
Filters?
Yeah.
Censorship?
Yeah.
Okay. It seems to me that ideally what you want to do is have children get a chance to grow up and mature and get some perspective on sexuality before they're confronted with the luring power of images and ideas that they just can't be equipped to handle and put in perspective. And so I'm all for a certain level of censorship. I think it just makes a ton of sense. I mean, I lived a very, very protected childhood. I had not seen a naked female body until I was in college. I was working at a store at Stanford, and the guy who was working with me would routinely take the Playboy magazines out and would leave the centerfold out on a work table in the back room while he worked. And normally he would put it away, but you know, one time I went back there and he had the centerfold all laid out. And I believe that was my first encounter with a naked female body. And it was just the visceral experience. I mean, it was somebody might as well have just hit me in the stomach. It was just such a powerful, powerful jolt. Well, you know, imagine if I was a 10-year-old or a 9-year-old when that was my experience. I mean, maybe it would have been a different experience. I don't know. But if you were just past puberty or something and you hadn't, I mean, at that point, I had a fairly well-developed sense of responsibility, and what I wanted in life and who I was and the fact that I wanted to obey God and follow Jesus and that kind of stuff. I mean, that stuff was pretty well in place. But what if I wasn't there yet and I'm encountering that for the first time? Well, I'm glad I didn't. You know, I'm glad I didn't have to come to terms with that until later. we don't have the luxury of living in that world I lived in any longer. I mean, it's really, I'm sorry. I'm sorry we did this to you, but it's a treacherous world out there right now with respect to sexuality. So basically I'm saying I'm all for it. I'm all for censorship.
Would you say the same to like self-censorship, even if you're old enough?
I would, yeah. I think we need to know ourselves enough to know what do I need to avoid in order to avoid being lied to in a way that I can't resist believing? I think so. And I can't make that decision for someone else, and you can't make that decision for me, but I just think as individuals we need to be alert to the possibility that, I mean, take something like pornography. If I'm right, if it is this sort of drug-like addiction, one of the reasons I don't smoke dope and shoot heroin is because I may not be able to stop. Not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons. And that pornography, I think, has that kind of effect on people. And it can be very, very powerful and get its hooks in you, and then you can't stop. Or at least it's very difficult. Well, one way to avoid that is to avoid it up front. Just not let it get its hooks in you. And that's where self-censorship becomes, I think, crucial, is that I protect myself from images, ideas, pictures, and so on that I don't know if I'm equipped to combat.
Okay, one last question. What about, I heard recently of a college that, like, basically put filters on its internet, on its like general internet. So there you have like censorship of people who should be old enough to know like right and wrong. What would you say to that?
Well, I can understand it, and I'm not in principle against it. I think you're doing a tremendous service to a lot of people. It's not going to solve the problem. And so if they are under any illusions that it's going to solve any problems, I think they're mistaken about that. But in principle, I can understand them trying to do a kind thing to people. And I agree.
So what would you say about arguments that internet filters also block off so-called educational material?
Excuse my language, but I think that's bull. I mean, yes, it may. But the objection that people raise, that's not their objection. I mean, especially if you can, I mean, maybe I'm technologically naive, but it seems to me that you can get around those things and get your education. If you want an education, you can fight hard enough for it and get it.
Along that line, I can imagine that someone, a young person nowadays, I mean, it seems like what you're saying is even if parents use filters, whatever they can do, I mean, something is probably going to break through at some point because of our culture, and the parents aren't perfect, and, you know, something slips through. So I can imagine that a young person, you know, having an experience similar to yours, but at a younger age, with the internet or whatever, sees something they know they shouldn't, but then experience something. It's like, well, you said, you know, you wouldn't take drugs and stuff because you might not be able to stop, but usually someone's not going to pin you down and force you to try that first
hit.
But with something like that visually, I can imagine someone really struggling because they didn't intend to see it. But you know, what would you say to someone like that who, I mean, it's not that you can't, I mean, What I would want to say is your struggle is not necessarily the sin. You want to get past that.
Right.
What do you do with
it? Right. No, exactly. Yeah. No, the actual, I think that's what I didn't have a clear enough handle on, is the actual biological response. That I was inclined to think that that was sinful in and of itself. And I don't think that's right. I mean, I'm just hardwired to respond to certain stimuli. And that in of itself is not wrong. But it's what do I do with that? Take Jesus. Did Jesus have any sort of response to females? I'm inclined to think that he probably did. That what was desirable, he probably experienced as desirable, just like anyone else did. His sinlessness, I would imagine, consisted of him being able to virtually immediately going, but I'm not married to her, so why would I want that? I mean, just out of a kind of innocence that immediately put it in perspective, the reality is that woman is not available to me, so that sort of settles it, doesn't it? The thing that we as sinful males struggle with, Jesus did spontaneously and automatically. We have to struggle with that because we have to remind ourselves that it's true, and then have to remind ourselves that it makes a difference that it's true, and remind ourselves that we ought to prefer what's true to what's false. I mean, things that I don't think would have been an issue for Jesus. But the actual biological responsiveness probably would have been his experience as well. That's not wrong. That's as it should be. That's how we were made.
You've spoken a little bit about living in reality, and I guess I'm wondering the parameters of that, and if we should not have like a forethought about future interactions, I guess. I'm not really sure exactly what my question is, but a second one I think would also be why it is that we so often to desire not to live in reality.
That's a good question. It's hard to define what I'm driving at there. I'm not against works of the imagination. I like fantasy. I like to read fantasy, but that's not what I'm talking about. You know, the stuff that Stephen Lawhead is writing, don't have any problem with that. Imagining what something might be, I don't have any problem with that. I mean, God gave us an imagination, and if we use it within the bounds in which it ought to be used, I think that's fine. What I'm getting at, I called it an evil use of our imagination. What I'm driving at is where I cross over a line and I really want and prefer reality to be other than God made it. And so what's at root there is a rebellion against the world that God gave us and that God created. I'm rejecting that, rebelling against that, and saying it would have been better if it was this way. I don't know this for a fact, but it wouldn't surprise me if you were to find married men who are addicted to pornography who actually prefer the pornography to sexual relations with their wife. That wouldn't surprise me. Because it seems to me part of what's happening there is, I don't want sex to be what you made it to be, God. I want it to be this thing that we as a culture have invented. And I prefer that to what it actually is. That's what I'm getting at, is that we don't reject and rebel against the world that God actually made and accept it and accept our place to live in that world and be the people God wants us to be in that world and in that context. That's what I'm trying to say. Does that make sense?
I was wondering, what does it mean to keep your focus on Christ? And when people say that, are they talking about Jesus as a man or Jesus as a risen Savior? How do we do that?
Did I use that phrase?
No, but...
Okay. Because if I've used that phrase, I wouldn't have any idea what I said. I would guess that what people mean is that's just a kind of jargonish way of saying keep your focus on doing what's obedient, what's good, what's right. I would hope that's what they mean. If they mean something other than that, that would be odd.
Well, I was just thinking, like you said, that Jesus could relate to sexual feelings, and if he can relate to everything we relate, we can experience, then that somehow comfort or help seeing that he can relate to what we're going through?
Well, I think so, in the sense that he then becomes our model. He becomes our example that we would want to seek to emulate him. He pursued righteousness not because he was immune to the temptations that we face, but because he put them in perspective. He just didn't yield to them and allow the temptations to persuade him to do what's wrong, or to do what's evil, or to do what's disobedient to God, because it was always more important to be obedient to God than yield to some urging. Well, if that was possible for him, then it's metaphysically possible for me, because I'm a human being too. I'm a sinner, so I'm going to fail, and I'm going to bumble my way through in a way that Jesus didn't. But at least it's an ideal out there that I can seek to emulate as much as a sinner can do. In that sense, I think it's encouraging. Okay, thanks.